Fuel Stop Chats is recorded live over Zoom. Please check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Fuel Stop Chats. And also, if you're brave enough to want to watch us, check us out on our YouTube channel. Search Fuel Stop Chats for the show recordings and other additional videos. As always, like and subscribe. And if you have a show idea, feel free to reach out to us at fuelstopchats@gmail.com. Again, fuelstopchats@gmail.com. If you like our podcast, like and subscribe. Throw us a rating. Tell your friends, and let's grow the community. Thanks for listening. Key the intro. Intro. We are recording.
Good evening, everybody. Here we are for another thrilling episode of Fuel Stop Chats. Tonight on our Fuel Stop Chat, we're going to visit with, you know, our fashion diva, Todd Ketterman, making a return. And he's brought along a friend. Russell, how are you? Russell is, listen, man, the legends are huge. The stories are tall. The stories are, you know, but here's the thing I want to know. I want to know the real truth behind the start of the black motorcycles.
That's well, also, I believe it's Dr. Russell Lowe.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I've recently received the award of
Dr. That's what I want to know about. I want to know about that, but yeah, I'll let it go back to Chris.
Yeah, so the beginning of the black motorcycles happened in Brooklyn, New York, in about,
2012, 2013, somewhere like that, yeah.
Yeah, 2012. And we met, me and Todd met in a community garage. You know those types? They were just actually, it was really ahead of its time, you know? It was like right at the beginning of that whole sort of do-it-yourself kind of trend where people could come and rent some space, leave your bike in storage. But this one had a workshop as well, and that's what made it special, I think. And I thought that you'd have to pay like an hourly fee to work in the workshop, but no, that wasn't it. You, as soon as you parked your bike there, you could do as much work on your bike as you like. And I went fucking nuts. I was there on a research sabbatical. I was working at a university at the time, and I flew over to New York to do some proper university academic type work, and went into this sort of community workshop and dropped the academic like a potato and got stuck in the bike. Bought a CB750, chopped the back of it off on the first day, and it was probably the second day that I met Todd. I think he walked in there and it was like he was a bit fresh behind that. We were all looking a bit better back then. but he was
sort now of Russell. Player. I gotta ask you. Make sure you tell the story of what it was like me coming in with my shiny new DR650, looking over at you and how I used to bust your balls all the time going like, what the fuck are you building? And are you actually going to ride that thing?
Fuck. It was like, see the people at the workshop, the community garage thing came in two flavors. Three flavors. People that store their nice bikes. That's flavor number one. Flavor number two are people that cut their bikes and pull their bikes apart and never did anything. Like they did that all in a terrible rush of testosterone and sometimes fueled with coffee and booze. And then the third people are the ones who actually chopped things up and actually did something with them. And nobody knew if I was going to be number two or number three at the beginning because I chopped this thing on the first day. And then Todd rolls in the second day with his fucking nice DR650, which I'm embarrassed to say was in my possession. Well, it was in my.
I didn't tell that story. So.
I was the custodian of that bike when it got stolen. Outside, where was I staying? Todd, do you remember
flipping? Like Bed-Stuy or you wherever. Yeah.
Anyway, I didn't know that you didn't leave a bike outside with a
here's the interesting thing. I want to interject. What was interesting was that Russell at that particular garage, and he tells a lot. He describes it perfectly, but there wasn't really anybody like doing anything. Even though you had this beautiful area to work, and you had the welders and the grinders, you had everything you need. You had lifts. No one had even really put their bike on a lift before. So I was kind of drawn, not in a weird way, but I was drawn. Russell was always there working. And the interesting thing, and as a teacher, he could go into this more, but when I think when you saw me drawn to you, you were like, oh, well, okay. You know, there's the fucking grinder and there's that. And if you want to hang, I'll teach you, but you also got to put in the work. So.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was a fucking, it was a, it was great. It like Todd says, it was really open. Not many people were using it at the time. And so it meant that I had free rein and I could just grab this and grab that and fucking just go hard, you know? And, not many people there could weld either. I don't think anyone else was welding.
No.
There, and so that made me, you know, gave me the ability to make some friends, right? Because, you know, I'm a Kiwi fucking over in New York, fucking like, fucking somebody fucking be my friend, you know. And Todd rolls in, and it's like, well, he doesn't look very threatening, he's a nice looking, clean, fucking fella, you know, lots of, as we've mentioned, lots of testosterone and fucking. But doesn't seem to be too scary. So if I can, and with the DRZ, it's like, okay, we can chop that thing up. but you know, that didn't last for long though, did it, Todd? You got something, you got a CB750 pretty soon.
Well, I mean, I told the story about, you know, how, you know, once you got that, cause I was always like, hey, let's go for a ride. And the weather got nice and I'm always pulling out the DR and coming back and then like, hey, when are we going to go for a ride? Make a long story short, when you did finish it, we took that nice ride up to the Indian Museum and saw the Wall of Death and all that shit and rode back. That's really when we got to kind of talk about our lives outside of, you know, the shop there. But, and then, you know, you had this bike running. You, at one point I had to run up to the store or something. You said, hey, there's the bike, take it. And I never looked back at that point. I was hooked. It used to always say, no, you're going to have a project bike. And I'm like, nah, I'll never have more than one bike. And then,
Yeah. So
what was the formalization of the black motorcycles?
Oh, right.
When did you guys consummate this marriage?
Well, yeah, in a diner across the road, wasn't it?
I think do you have the feather bed frame there with you?
I do. It's downstairs. Yeah, I do.
I mean, that's really what culminated it. It was $300 a piece to go buy a $900 feather bed frame, right?
Which the dirty Kiwi fucking put in his hand and took back the fucking, took home with him. But what a scumbag. This is the point of this podcast is to track me down and get me to admit that I owe Todd $300
for a motorbike. We got it on tape.
Yeah, we got it.
We got it recorded now, Russ.
All recorded.
Plus interest. That's it.
So Russell basically convinced me that, you know, he had this great idea that we were going to basically, he knew that the feather bed frame, and he can go into this way better than me, but it was like the ultimate frame for building a motorcycle because it just basically fit everything that you could ever want to do. So there was a guy down in Philly that was actually building feather bed frames because to actually buy a feather bed frame, a real one, was fucking insane. So he found a guy down in Philly that was welding. It was in a church or something, and he was welding these frames off of, and a jig. So he's like, hey, let's go down and check out these feather bed frames. And the whole idea was that we were going to build motorcycles or do something with these things, and we were actually going to do some shit. And so him being an entrepreneur, and me too, you came up with it. I was explaining the name of the black motorcycles and the black square and all that kind of stuff, so I want you to tell the story. So
we're trying to change our lives pretty much, you know, like Todd was sort of working in IT, still is, isn't he? I've only just managed to escape the academic world.
Working is a stretch.
Yeah, well, anyone in IT, holy shit, ask yourself. And any academic, you know, what a fun job that is. But, you know, we're all trying to make a change. We're all trying to go, you know what? What would we really love to be doing? And we'd love to be making custom motorbikes. Or
sure.
For me, anything about motorbikes I'd love to be doing. And so we're sort of like, well, let's start something, you know. And I've been doing some research on this crazy Russian from his name is Kazimir Malevich, how you'd say it more correctly. And he was famous for painting a black square in 1915. He painted this black square, coincidentally, on my birthday in 1915. And so there's a few connections there for me, just thinking that this thing is just like a real fuck you to the art world. And it really fit to me with this notion of motorcycling and just really, you know, pushing limits and going where you've never been before, and really changing the whole paradigm. You know,
I gotta say, man, you look really good for being born in 1915. I mean, amazing. I don't know what's in the water down there, but you Kiwis got it going on.
We don't drink a lot of water down here. That's probably the trick.
There you go.
So Russell, wasn't there also some notion to the, you know, the perfection and the imperfection? I'm not trying to go too deep, but, yeah. but I think the yep. one thing that was interesting about you and I was I told this story. You know, I tend to want everything to be perfect, and you're like, oh shit, let it rust, and it looks better that way. And you know, you can see now some of the stuff I do. I mean, it's got that touch to it that you worked on with me, which is be happy with what you have. And the whole Mullowitz thing was that as well. Like, there is perfection and imperfection. So
yeah, well, the concept of it is very simple. It's a black square, right? And everyone in your mind knows what a black square looks like and can picture it right there. But the fact is, it was actually painted in the dark, and it was painted over the top of pre-existing artworks that he'd made. And we only discovered this about 80 years after it was painted, when it started to crack and the surface of the oil paint started to crack like old oil paintings do. And you could actually see some colors and shit underneath it. And then when you x-rayed the painting, he found a complete composition, a complete what they call a supremacist artwork composition. And so Mullowitz said that this painting was the origin, it was the first thing. And when you x-rayed it, you found out, in fact, it wasn't. It was probably the last thing. It was probably the thing that he did after he developed the whole idea of supremacist art, of a sort of a proto sort of futurist art back in sort of 1915. And then he covered it all up, only to be revealed later on by the imperfections. So imperfections which sort of give depth to the story, you know. And the Japanese call it wabi-sabi, I think is the Japanese term for that perfect imperfection, that crack. Like, there's a whole art field of taking smashed plates and gluing them back together.
Yep.
Well, I'm Chris, you're nodding, yeah.
It was just featured on a TV show that we watched. This guy had bought one for his wife. It was a bowl in Japan that he had purchased, and it had been cracked, put back together artistically. But it was the making something from nothing, mm-hmm. or the return of something yeah. from nothing, right?
Right.
Concept, and it created a whole art movement. Now those pieces are worth, you know, a lot of money. It's crazy.
It's a sort of, like, I like to sort of, you know, we come to art, come to motorcycling from quite sometimes different backgrounds, but when you bring something from outside to motorcycling, it can really enrich it, you know. In any motorsport, any sort of vehicle related thing is sort of the same, I think, you know. And we're seeing lots of really interesting influences come into motorcycles and hot rods and that sort of thing from the world of fine art and stuff. You know?
So, hey Russell, what
movement
so,
like that?
Sorry, I just wanted to fast forward a little bit in the you know, spirit of time and how much time we have here. I want to kind of fast forward a little bit through this and just kind of get to almost current day where you're at. So I think there's some interesting things. Clearly, you're a, you know, motorcycle enthusiast, more than enthusiast. You're an artist for sure. You're a motorcycle enthusiast. You've gotten your PhD in, help me out, motorcycle fab or motorcycle design. I explained to them one of the pieces that you did where you put an engine in a box and made everybody put their head inside of it and breathe, you know, no, I'm just kidding. There was something you did, but I want you to kind of draw into that, because I think people that are listening to this, you've taken it to become more of a life, there's lifestyle, but you've taken it beyond that. And I think that's the something that's certainly, I think, interesting for people to know more about.
Yeah, yeah. I from my aspect, it's definitely on the PhD side of it, with, you know, so many people going after their PhDs or people that don't know too much about a PhD. They just think, well, it's, you know, academia. You're either a real doctor that, you know, you go and work on people or animals or whatever. But there's also PhDs within mathematics, PhDs in English, PhDs in history. But your PhD is something that I've never heard of before. And to me, it's exciting because it breaks so many windows of what, you know, the art of the possible, of what you can do within academia.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, it's a PhD in fine art that I have. And it's a newer version of a PhD called a PhD by practice. And what's interesting about it is that it's not an entirely written document like a regular PhD. It's a split between a written document and practice-based artwork in my case. But it could be, a different, an engineering practice or a scientific practice, you know. In my case, I ended up with about 75,000 words. And it talked about the sublime and virtual reality, about strange kind of concepts of understanding things to be real and to be virtual. And the practice work was things like you see here, the and things that Tom was just describing, these motors and boxes and the experiences out on the great sort of wide expanse of the salt, which you can see. You might be able to see that behind me.
Yeah. So for the people that are listening to the podcast, check out the YouTube channel. It's under Fuel Stop Chats. So we've got some screen shots going on the back behind Russell of some of the pictures of the bikes that he's conceived and designed, and now the salt flats. So that, check out the YouTube channel if you want to see the pictures.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks, James. The notion that really drew me into this was the idea of using motorcycles as artwork and most importantly, the experience of it, the visceral sort of terror that you get as you ride really fast across the salt, the smell and the fear that you'd feel if you were jammed up close to a motor that's revving its tits off and the component could fly apart at any moment. The oil could sort of burst out the side of the cases, and the petrol could, you know, come out of the fuel lines or the tank or the carburetor for fuel injection and catch a light and pour all over you if you were sort of, you know, trapped in this sort of confinement with them, you know. The notion of trying to give a different experience of art than one that just sort of a passive take it or leave it. You know, I'm in a gallery, I look at a painting and I go, oh yeah, that's okay. You know, and I was trying to capture that feeling of the Kazimir Malevich work, that he said that once he painted that painting, he looked at it and he thought he couldn't eat, sleep or drink for a week after painting it. And I wanted to make artworks that gave people that kind of reaction. You know?
That's amazing. We were talking to a guest a few weeks back, and he said that riding a motorcycle was akin to a fish swimming through the water, and you don't breathe. The whole of the experience washes through, like water washes through the gills of a fish. The experience of riding a motorcycle washes through you, you know, like that. And I thought, man, that's one of the richest descriptions, you know, put it to words of, you know, cause you try to explain to somebody that doesn't ride what it's like to ride. And you can explain the fact that, you know, we sit on bombs and we go really fast and we're always on the edge of the bomb exploding, you know, and there's that, but then there's the elements around you. You know, you talked about the smells and just how into the environment you become, you know, when you're on a bike. And so it's a beautiful thing, man, making art out of that and getting people engaged from a completely different perspective of the man-machine connection, from an artistic and aesthetic reaction versus a visceral mechanical reaction.
That's critical, I think. You know, that Chris, most people look at motorbikes as they sort of sexualize them. You know, it's like they even talk about them as, you know, in sort of feminine terms of that's a sexy bike, and you know, and it's all seems to be about the look of it and where that sort of riding feeling, that kind of, you know, that one, that sort of low flying kind of quality. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if Todd's mentioned it, but one part of my PhD, I went to Bonneville 3 times, the salt flats over in Utah there. And the third time we couldn't even race because it was cooled off. What's that? You've got your...
That's my bike sitting on the salt.
Oh, right, in the background there. Yeah. It's, you know, yeah. Well, you know, Chris, it's a gorgeous, fucking a magical place. And so we couldn't even ride this year in 2015. So I thought, what could I do? What could I do to capture that sort of intensity of riding a motorcycle? And I looked around and it's like, oh, fuck, you know what they do? They do skydiving over the lake. So you could jump out of a plane and plummet towards the earth. And then I thought, fuck, you know, that's a, you know, I'm okay with flying, but I'm not like, it's not the thing that I prefer to do. It's, you know, but I'm not going to panic, right? But jumping out of a perfectly good plane, absolutely. And I'm back,
James,
and I'm back
at home. James, you're a jump master. What? Why do you do that?
I was in the Army. I did it for the money.
Okay. Sure you did.
Well, I'm like, fuck that. I'm not doing that. And then it was like, well... But what would Kazimir Malevich do? And he'd be like, well, he'd jump out of the fucking plane, wouldn't he?
He'd throw the motorcycle out of the plane.
Yeah. So I can't jump by myself. So I got strapped onto the front of some guy in my race leathers, and put an EEG on my head. So it measured my brain waves, and then put a blindfold on and fucking jumped out of the plane. And or got thrown out of the fucking plane, to be honest with you. And
you missed the sensory piece of seeing it.
Oh, but that was what I was trying to deny, the visuality of it. I just wanted to be plummeting or floating or whatever the sensation was. I wanted to experience that in the complete darkness, like Kazimir Malevich painting that painting, you know. I wanted to sort of see if I could be present in the sublime. And there's moments on the EEG before it goes completely batshit bonkers crazy, where there's these sort of spikes that relate to certain brain functions that are very kind of surprising in that situation, you know. But I kind of you know, in the darkness found myself somewhere else, you know. And kind of, in a way, at one with the universe, if that doesn't sound too fucking esoteric and wanky.
Yeah. Yeah.
Little touch. I do want to say, when Russell was sharing this story, it was making me think about, and I shared this thing with you guys before, that I had a major shift in me the very first time. Again, I mean, I was always the shiny, you know, nice bike, the whole thing. And you know, I would bust his balls every time I saw this motorcycle's diary, rust bucket piece of whatever that he was building. Even rode with him all the way up and back, and it just kind of like saw it, you know, riding up. But there was nothing that really drew me to it. I had to go up to AutoZone or something and pick something up. We were at the shop and he was like, oh yeah, take my bike. It's sitting right out in front. And I remember putting on the fucking old helmet and had the goggles on it and the gloves that he used to weld in. And I rode, I literally felt like I was transported back in time and got on this bike and, I mean, fucking kickstarted it, whatever, and laid over it, you know, that cafe racer style. And I was just like, fuck this. I was just like, this is like amazing. And it was what you described as that sensory. It was there. It was real. And it was something that I went, you know, you could smell the fuel burning off, the oil, everything burning, everything's like going on. But it was, for me, it was like you jump back into, what was that, like a 1976, you know, CB750 single overhead cam. You were jumping back to 1976 in a way and going like, fuck, it was like life-changing for me to go through that. So I get what you're talking about. So
that's why I keep that 1975 BMW around.
Yeah. So, and I totally get where you're coming from with the blindfolding and the jumping out. I mean, when I was in the Army, I was a paratrooper. I have over 100 jumps, and every single one of them, my eyes were closed. So I know exactly what, but it's more out of fear. But yeah, I mean, no, I'm just kidding. We used to call them night jumps. Eyes are always closed during the night jumps. But the jumping at night, something close to that or akin to that, it's very different, because when you jump out and there's nothing there, or jumping out into clouds and there's nothing there, you really find yourself. So I'm in tune with what you're saying 100%. Really cool stuff.
The other flip side is the black square has this sort of white border, and most people just think it's the background. But that's the sort of great expanse, you know? And these bikes that I'm riding on the salts, I think give you that same kind of experience of the night jump that I'm talking about, my blindfold, where you're on this bike, you're on the this massive salt flat, and all you can see around you until the horizon is whiteness, and it just blurs all into blurs into the sky on the horizon. It just takes over your whole sort of experience, and you become, you know, you're traveling at approaching 200 miles an hour, and you've just got the view, the sound of the bike, and I've got another one up on the screen at the moment of the latest V8 powered bike, and that thing is just fucking ballistic, and it's like riding a fucking artillery shell. You know, and it's just thunderous with its exhaust sound. It's got no muffler or anything like that. But there's a sense of stillness about it. You're traveling at, you know, close to 200, and there's a stillness about it that the sense of denying, you know. You've got this mad volume, this mad sound, this sort of wind buffeting you around, and yet the ground's not moving. Or it is, but it doesn't seem to be because it's so big. You know?
Now, do you think that you would ever do something on the salt where you would, because I know how they set up the lanes, if you had somebody talking to you in a headset and you were blindfolded going down the salt where they could guide you, you know, a little right, a little left, so you're staying in the
don't
lane.
Don't give them any.
Hey, that was actually done in a car.
Yeah.
And it has been done at Bonneville on a very low-powered tricycle kind of a thing. But I don't know if you guys heard about it, but there's a guy down here in Australia. So I'm a Kiwi living in Australia because there's a big salt flat in South Australia too. And that's where the shots that I'm showing you on the screen are from. And there's a guy, Ben Felton. And Ben went blind at about 32, and he's pitch black blind. No, can't see a thing. It's not like one of these, you know, blurry blinds. He's totally black blind. And he did a deal with my race body out here, the DLRA, to be followed down the track by an ex MotoGP racer from back in the would be the 90s, I guess, Kevin McGee. He won a few MotoGPs. Maybe Todd would remember him. He was a mad rider. And he had to retire early, but he's a crazy fucking guy, absolutely mental. And he follows Ben down the track. This year, they were both on Hayabusas, I think. Well, maybe Ben was on his Hayabusa and Kevin was on a Kawasaki, I think, a ZX-10. And they are looking to do over 173 miles an hour. And exactly like you're talking, one has headphones on and the other, and Kevin out the back has a microphone, and he's like left, left, right, left, left, right, and then fucking when it goes bad, it's like right, right, fucking right. Yeah, there's been a few moments where it's like right, fucking right. But yeah, I know them quite well, and they're fucking Kevin's gonna ride my fucking V8 bike next year, and fucking they've just bought a car as well, so I think they're gonna do dual car and motorbike blind world record attempts. So they've gotten pretty close. I think they've done about 165 miles an hour.
Wow.
So dead fucking blind. Can you imagine that? Fucking
we gotta talk to that guy on the podcast.
Yeah, that's awesome though. And it, I mean, just yeah. If I ever found myself in that situation, I think that yeah, I would have to do shit like that too. So we only got a few more minutes left on this, and we can extend out if we want to. But I'm curious what you've gotten into as far as okay, you did some stuff out at NYU on the academic side. You know, obviously within art. You eventually make it back to where you are now. You're in Sydney.
I'm in, yeah, just north of Sydney in a little town called Newcastle.
Okay. So you've got a garage, you're working on bikes, you have a salt flat out there. What are you working on as far as bikes now? Because I don't know if you're sticking with petro or yeah. Are you getting into electrics or where is your designs going with, you know, in the spirit of your PhD and art?
Yeah. So I'm still,
what's going on with Dr. Russell?
I've recently taken a redundancy from my academic position. So I got a little bit of a payout and I've started my own company. It's called Julia Motorsports. And I'm going to be making electric racing motorcycles. And
really?
I'll do some street bikes as well. I'm going from the sort of absolute bedlam of the V8 sort of open-headed thing to the absolute silence of electric race bikes. And it sort of, I want to see, you know, you've heard that saying, silence is deafening. I want to see if it is. You know, and so I've got a bike that I'm experimenting on downstairs. It's a 2011 Harley Sportster, and I've pulled the motor out of that, and I'm going to do some other things that I can't quite tell you just yet, and it's going to be, but the end result is it's going to be converted to electric, and it's going to be done in such a way that I hope nobody's ever seen one before. So looking to sort of really change.
Yeah, that's exciting. That's really exciting. So we got about a minute left. Do we want to extend it out?
I'm happy to keep chatting if you want.
All right, yeah, why don't we – so we're going to take a quick commercial break for the listeners at home, and we'll see you on the other side of the break.
Learning history is something taught in school. Experiencing history is a right seldom exercised. Either experiencing the American Civil War by walking its battlefields and touching the soil where blood was shed, or experiencing musical history from the studios where the lyrical touchstone was created and recorded, the textile of history should be experienced firsthand. Participants in this journey should be riding a motorcycle from historical location to historical location, so that the environment can wash through them in the open air. Ride History provides an intimate, educated, and personal experience guiding its riders through history on the freedom of two wheels. Check out www.ridehistory.com for available tours of the Gettysburg Battlefield, or ride through America's entry into the Industrial Revolution on the oil field tour. The Knox Tour from Fort Ticonderoga to Boston, or the 8-day rhythm tour starting in Atlanta and hitting Nashville, Memphis, Muscle Shoals, Jackson, and New Orleans. Ride through American history at ridehistory.com.
There you go.
Welcome back. I'm not going to lie. I took a bio break. Anyway, we're back talking to Dr. Lowe, Dr. Madlow. Anyway, Russ, one of the things that I've been really reading about a lot is, and everybody seems to be getting into this e-bike thing. And we were talking last night while we were playing cards. In fact, 200-mile-an-hour motorcycle charges 0 to full in 3 hours, 300-mile range, $29,000.
Yep.
Commercially available. Damon is the name of the company. Anyway, and we were talking briefly on the break about the boat company that's perfected an interesting motor for building things around. And then I was reading about massless batteries and glass batteries. Is there anything that you can talk about as far as where you're going with the direction you're headed as far as the power source, or is that still too secretive?
Oh, look, it's not that secretive. It's like I'm come from a world of sharing everything I know, you know. So the academic world is really about just getting things out there, you know. I'm new to the electric game. I've got this sort of, I guess, experience and pedigree in internal combustion engine powered motorcycles, but the electric thing is new for me. I believe that the hub motor is going to be the future of electric motorcycles. And by that, I mean motors that actually exist in the wheels.
Yeah.
And I think you've got two wheels, so why not have power on both of them? And the dynamics that come with that kind of power as well.
That gives torque steer a whole new meaning.
yeah, that's true. Lots of problems to overcome, and for me that's an exciting time, and it's very much like the electric sort of thing is very much like the Wild West at the moment, especially in motorcycles, because it's not getting much attention at all from the legacy manufacturers, you know, and that's the same sort of for car as well, but motorcycles, because they're much they're kind of a little fringe, and they're the profit margins are much less than in the automobile world, there's just fuck all attention, and that means that there's so much scope for innovation, and like you say, Damon didn't exist just a few years ago, and now look at them. They the figures I read were 200 200 200, you know, and all good numbers, you know, in every respect.
Yeah.
I like I said a little bit earlier, I've left the academic world, but I'm not going to leave it entirely. I'm going to go back as a sort of a consultant, if you like, to try and make connections between industry and academia from the industry side. And I know how it sort of works being at universities for the last two decades, how it works on the inside. And now I'm beginning to sort of explore how it can work from an industry perspective. And so I'd like to be connecting specifically local Australian-based businesses with Australian universities, and to leverage the intellectual property that's developed in a lot of these universities to commercialise it. And so working with engineers and as well as sort of material scientists and computer scientists in universities to solve some of the obvious problems with hub motors. You know, hub motors are heavy, and it's the last place that you would weight in a motorcycle in the wheels, you know, and you know how much you can spend on a nice set of wheels to reduce just fractions of ounces, you know. Putting 30 kgs, 60 pounds in your back wheel is retarded. But it's the exact kind of thing that I like to start with, you know, because people don't consider it seriously for a performance motorcycle, and yet I think there's real opportunities there. The same with battery technology. Australia is a little bit like Texas for oil, for sun, you know. We're like, we've got this overabundance of daylight and sun, and you know, we're going to be, we could be a global superpower in solar energy and storage and that sort of thing. And you might have heard that Elon Musk has done some of his largest battery arrays in South Australia,
yep,
right next door to the salt lake that I race on, you know. So there's some happy coincidences there. But yeah, so electric is, I think there's a few fields of motorcycle design and development that are untouched still. You know, you could probably count electric custom motorcycles on one hand.
Yeah.
Damon is probably full power to them. I absolutely support them. I'd love to have a go on one of their bikes. But it's very much in that field of that's a sports bike. It looks to me like a Triumph, you know, but it's not Japanese looking. It's not American. It's not Italian. Kind of like, if I was guessing just at a glance, it looks kind of Triumph-like, you know. And for me, I'd like to be sort of exploring things that don't look like anything else you've seen before, you know. So to really, really take advantage of some of the opportunities that the electric bikes do. I rode a custom electric bike the other day by a friend of mine, Toby, at Ed Motorcycles, and fucking rode it for 20 seconds. And inside of 5 seconds, I'm like, here's my checkbook. No, what's it gonna? I need this bike. This is fucking brilliant. It was the most aggressively accelerating bike that I've ever been on. And I've been on some fucking monsters, I'll say that. And this thing was just the visceral reaction to it is hard to sort of describe, but it felt like it was going, the way the power came on was like, yeah, it was never, ever going to stop. And I know that it only made 50 kilowatts, but the way it accelerated with 100% torque from zero, it felt like that. My brain knows 150 kilowatts, that's about a quarter of what the V8 bike makes. It's a half of what the, or a third of what the GSX R1000 race bike that I had made. It's about the same as a Harley Sportster, nothing much. I ride the thing and I'm like, fuck me, I feel like I'm going to be crushed with speed. It was that kind of reaction, you know, and I had to, like, I wanted it, you know.
I think for me, the thing that's crazy is, you know, you're so used to listening to the RPMs of an engine for shifting and for doing everything else. This bike doesn't do anything but go. It doesn't make any noise. It just, that's what's crazy. I would love to see a steampunk guy, because I love the art of the steampunk type design, do an e-vehicle and an e-bike like that.
I was at a MotoGP race, Indianapolis, back when they were running MotoGP in Indianapolis. And they had actually I was there with Keith. We all know Keith.
Random.
And anyway, he knew one of the girls that was racing on the e-bikes, and they, you know, in between races, they were out racing. And, you know, you're listening to the GP bikes go. And I mean, that's just incredible. And then we're just walking around, and literally you hear like from Tron, like, and we're like, oh my, all you hear is the wind.
Yeah.
But the flip side of that, the interesting part of that, as a spectator, a lot of the feedback was kind of negative from a spectator, because you're there to hear the noise and the, you know, you want that to go the engine fast, yeah, you know, and you're just, zoom, you know, it's like, okay.
I think, you know, what's interesting about that though is, and I haven't been to an all e-bike race, but if the focus wasn't on the engine sounds, right? Yeah. And the focus was on the techniques, I think about the sensory, you know, when you've removed one, you've heightened the others, right? That's just organically what we do. You take away sight, what happens? Sound becomes incredibly acute, smell, everything else, right? Because your body's just going to start compensating for that sensory loss. And if you were watching a race and there was no engine noise, what else would you get? What would your brain be affixed
to? Well, yeah, I mean, turn on the next MotoGP race and just turn off the volume. Yeah. That's what it's like. That's it.
Yeah. But I think now the Isle of Man had an e-bike class. I hope maybe next year they do it again and they have an e-bike. I hope that they have an e-bike class.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, are they still doing e-bike classes? I know they introduced it as a trial about 4 or 5 years ago, but I don't know if they kept doing it.
Yeah, I believe so. I believe they are still doing it, and they're getting up to, the internal combustion bikes are doing, have taken 100 years to get up to 130 mile an hour laps, which is just ballistic. But that's 130 mile an hour average around that course. The e-bikes are over 100, I think they're approaching 110 mile an hour laps now, and they're doing multiple laps now too. So not just the ice bikes are doing three laps. I think the electric bikes are doing the multiples now too. So what I'm trying to say is the progression is incredible. It's just, and everybody you talk to, I tried this out on a lot of people out on the salt. I'm like, so I'm going to be building, this is going to be the last petrol bike I do. I'm going to be building all electric from now on. And the responses from hardcore motorheads range from, the worst response was, yeah, that's inevitable, to fuck yeah, that's going to be brilliant, right? And I think I love the sound. I've got a picture of one of my sculptures up on the screen at the moment, which is with the side open. Usually the boxes are completely closed and you can't see anything, but you can start this motor up and run this thing. And it's a VFR 750, and it was included, that bike was included in the Art of the Motorcycle exhibition in New York in the Guggenheim Museum a few years ago. And they're beautiful. The V4 Honda 750 sound is just something else. You know, it's just the most magical sound. Unfortunately, this one was a bit sick, and I actually made it 4-1, and I killed the sound. It sounded fucking horrible. It would wake the dead. It was the loudest fucking thing you'd ever imagine. And in an art gallery, you can imagine how fucking intense this is. This black thing in a darkened room, fucking being revved, and all you can see is the operator's feet sticking out the. That's me climbing into it. I'll just put a picture up of me climbing underneath this thing, claustrophobic, and you have to climb right inside this box to share space with this motor, and then you run it from inside using the using some cables and shit.
You would hear that throughout the entire Guggenheim. That place is just one big tube.
Yeah, it's like a megaphone, isn't it?
Yeah. Wow. And so you're inside this box operating this engine that's on your picture?
Yeah. So you crawl into that sort of coffin-shaped bit at the bottom, which is shaped that way for obvious reasons, and you poke your hands up through the maybe on the feed you can see my
I see hand. Your arm sticking out, it looks like. Is that your arm sticking out on the side?
No, not in this picture. That's some geez, I hope it doesn't look like my arms. Maybe it's a bit blurry on the shot, but you reach up and you operate sort of toggle switches and push buttons to turn it on, and then you grab some cable, the throttle cable in particular, and the choke cable, and you sort of manipulate them to make the fucking thing run. But it's so fucking loud, and you're trapped inside there, and you can't see what the audience is thinking. All they can see is your little feet poking out the back of it. And what my point that I'm sort of driving at is that if anyone likes fucking loud sounds and motorbike noises, it's got to be me. And yet I think the appeal of the silence is is going to really pay dividends in the future. And maybe it'll attract a whole new sort of community of bikers, you know?
So here's an interesting one for you, and the tech guys will love this. So I'll do a little play here on it. But when they came out with Token Ring, which is a networking protocol, when they came out with Token Ring switches, which is almost an oxymoron, one of the problems was that in the Token Ring world with the mouths and the cows, you would hear this clicking sound. You would hear click, 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 and it told you that the equipment was working. Well, when they came out with the switches, the Token Ring switches, there was no noise. So people thought, well, it's not working. Something's not working. So these manufacturers, specifically Nortel and Bay Networks, and these guys went and actually built in this fabricated clicking sound into their switches so that the engineers would, and this is real, I've worked on them. Oh, yeah. So you'd hear the clicking. What's interesting is on your side, do you think that they will fabricate a running engine sound into an electric bike?
Yeah, absolutely. The
car manufacturers have done it.
Yeah. Yep. No, they do. And but there'll be a whole, I think that's a transition phase. You know, I think that's people yearning for what they feel that they've lost rather than looking forward to the things that they can gain, you know. And I think once a new generation comes up, that never really like my kid, he's 10 and he hates fucking loud. In fact, the first time I started up the V8 bike downstairs was a real breakthrough. I'd owned the motor for about a year when I was fabricating the bike, right? And this one day I fucking started it up in the basement. And Henry, my little boy, was upstairs. He was about 8 at the time. And I didn't know it was going to run, you know. And I hooked up the system and everything, and I fucking went, boom, and it fucking and I'd miswired the kill switch, so I couldn't turn the fucking thing off. And it was running, and so I boom, like this fucking epic sounding fucking thing, and I'm like, oh, fucking brilliant, you know. And then I fucking finally just pulled the power cable off to kill it off the battery and came upstairs to say, Henry, I just started my bike. And he wasn't in the lounge. And then I checked his room. He wasn't in the room. I'm like, where the fuck is he? And I went into my bedroom, and behind my bed, on the other side of the bed, he was curled up in the fetal position crying. Because he was fucking like scared of that much. The sound coming from the basement was fucking like hell opening up and demons ripping up from fucking hell in the basement. And he was fucking filled up in a ball, fucking sobbing. And I'm like, I was instantly fucking like, oh, but poor little guy, mixed with this is him. You know, this is
fucking. That sounds like, Russell, that reminds me of most of the nights that we were working in the shop. You know, one of us would end up in the fetal position, you know, and that.
Yeah, crying. Yeah. Fucking sobbing.
Todd likes that little spoon, man.
Oh, man. Good times.
When do you think you'll have even the prototype running?
Prototype by June 21st.
Awesome. Wow. Yeah. We want to tune back in with you and kind of keep pace with you, if you don't mind letting us visit in and check in on you once in a while.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Love to. Yeah. And I'll set up a Wi-Fi repeater in my workshop, so you don't have to look at shitty pictures on a screen. You can actually see where all the magic happens, you know. Yeah. Now, June 21st is my birthday. I'm turning 50 this year, and it's about time to get fucking serious. So it's a bit of a tight deadline, but I'm going to make it happen.
Yeah, my birthday's the 14th, but I won't be turning 50.
We can have a joint party, Chris.
Yeah, June 14th. Oh,
hey, Russell, if you're interested, just I'll throw this out. We are planning, and I don't know if you guys want to bleep this part out, but we are potentially planning a trip to the Isle of Man next year. So
not potentially. We're going to the Isle of Man.
I'm a potential.
You're the potential.
No, we already have.
We are going.
We have places for our tents. We already have ferry tickets. We're unfortunately going. We couldn't get the bikes to ride there because everybody for the last 2 years has been canceled. So everybody's bike rentals have been rolled over. So there's nothing. I mean, we were looking down in Milan. There's nothing for bikes. However, we may have a couple.
Got an outside chance.
But I'm not saying from where.
Nope.
Because I don't want anybody else to know about it. But.
Top secret.
We plan to have a couple bikes to ride around the island because we're gonna be there for Mad Sunday. And we want to do the track.
Don't die.
No.
Don't die. That's rule number one.
I mean, personally, I don't really know if I really want to do Mad Sunday just because you got all of the Tom, Dick, and Harry's out there that think they belong there to run at the open speeds. I mean, there's no speed limit on the mountain anyway. So do it during the day of any of the other days. They practice at 6 p.m. So you got all day to do it.
Yeah.
Depends on traffic.
You got to ride around it once.
Oh, no, we're definitely riding around it.
My 60th birthday next year, so I'm going.
Yeah, man, that's going to be fucking. So right back at the beginning, we were me and Todd and another friend of ours, Justin, from the Community Garage, were sitting around going, what should we do? You know, like I'm about to leave this sort of beautiful relationship we were building and head back over to Australia, and it's like, well, what can we do? What should we do, you know, to keep this thing alive, you know? And there were two, for my sort of opinion, there was two places that we could go, Bonneville or Isle of Man. It's like in racing, it seems to me those are the two meccas, you know, for racing. And the reason why Bonneville got it over the Isle of Man is, if I'm honest, probably because I thought I'd probably die if I went to the Isle of Man. And secondly, the Bonneville got it because we were allowed to ride. So we're actually allowed to race. And we raced Run What You Brung.
Yeah.
Which was our fucking shitty bikes that we built in New York, you know. But so it was, I really fucking envy the Isle of Man trip and would love to go as well.
It was definitely pretty sweet when they were announcing the black motorcycles on the salt, because we raced under that team. So, you know, it was epic. I mean, they were just over the whole loudspeakers, you know, now the black motorcycles. It's pretty fucking cool. Yeah.
Yeah. We need an e-bike team for, Isle of Man. There you go. That'll be the next decade.
2023.
Done. That's it.
Done.
2023, black motorcycles, e-bike, Isle of Man, done.
That's it.
Well, no. What we do is we have Julian Motorsports build the engine for a black motorcycles motorcycle. That's what we do.
And Russell, can you see everybody's names on the bottom of the screen?
On the bottom of, hang on a second.
Like my picture? Do you see my picture and there's my name on it? Are you using Zoom?
Yep.
So I love the black motorcycles.
That's brilliant. Because
that's my name.
Oh, fuck. Holy shit. Yeah, of course. I'm like Christopher. Yeah, I can see Christopher. I'd never fucking read your last name. Classic. Yeah, of course you love the black motorcycles. Now, what we need to do is get you sell that fucking old BMW of yours, and we'll put that into a battery pack.
There you go. Fundraiser.
What a horrible thing to say, Chris. We've only just met and I'm already selling you bikes. Fucking no, we'll just find some money from elsewhere.
I give up one for a battery pack. I get a sticker on the bike.
I have no doubt that if Russell was here with me, he would look at my F-150 and say, fucking, we got to take the V8 out of that fucking thing and fucking make a motorcycle.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I really appreciate how you moved from academia into sales, and you've totally embraced that, where you're trying to sell a a battery pack BMW to Chris. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good luck with that.
Didn't think it was gonna go this way today, but here we are.
Hey man, I would love to do it. I'd love to go Isle of Man, have an e-bike team, and tear it up. Let's do it.
You never know. All you got to do is set it out there, right? Just set it out.
Hey,
put it up to the universe.
If you don't say it, it won't come into being.
Isn't that how we play cards too? There was a little bit of that going around last night too, right? Like, well, you just fucking believe in yourself.
Yeah. Speaking into existence, I will win this game.
Yeah,
didn't well, listen, man, it's been great catching up with you, and thank you so much for spending some time with us. I definitely want to revisit this June 22nd
or
3rd so that we can hear how the 21st went. So the 21st for us will be perfect because it'll already have happened for you. We can speak to the future.
So what time is it there right now? Because I know it's like 9:30 at night, 10 o'clock here right now.
Yeah,
it's just Eastern time.
It's just turned midday on Friday. So I'm
14 hours.
Nice. I'm hitting you guys in the universe.
Yeah.
I will tell you this, Chris and James, I mean, as we're putting pins on the map of where to go, I've been wanting to get to Australia for a long, 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 long time. So we should definitely figure out how we can make that happen too.
Well, I don't know. I have to do a little finagling with Tammy because I lived with a girl from Swan Hill for 4 years. And I don't know if she'll let me go visit Australia.
She's a wise woman.
It's just like the bikes. I can't name any of my German bikes any former girlfriend name.
Nice.
Because I lived in Germany for 4 years. So she's like, I don't want to hear about some girl that you dated, popping up as the name of one of your bikes. I didn't date Italian girls, so I could buy a Ducati next. That would solve that problem.
There you go.
Nice.
But we definitely want to check back in with you, man, and check on the progress and see how things are going and let you give a shout out for more fundraiser ideas. I mean, other than selling my bike, but we'll get a battery pack going. And next time let's spend some time talking about the power source. I really do. Let's drill into the, glass, massless, whatever's coming next. That'd be great.
Absolutely. No, it's been fantastic to hear you, Chris, and fellas. It's really lovely to fucking lovely. I could talk about this shit for hours.
So could we? Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, and we were a little nervous meeting a friend of Todd's because you never know what you're gonna get.
So. Man, it's always a crapshoot, right?
Yeah,
one guy's got a PhD, and the other guy's putting frogs in his mouth. I mean, this is the extremes we're dealing with here.
Yep. That's it. Yep.
Perfect. Well, I'll get some frogs for my next visit with you guys.
By the way, Russell, they're referring to Keith, who you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, Keith. Oh,
yeah. Yep.
No, I'll say no more.
No surprise there.
You know what we're talking about. Okay.
No surprise there. Well, listen, we always typically sign this off like back in the old military days. We would say, like, Blackie out. But we say Ryder out, and that's how we kind of end our show. And so once again, thanks for joining us. And we'll look forward to tuning in with you guys next time. So James, Todd, Russell, Ryder out.
Ryder out, everybody. Thanks again.
Thanks, guys. Cool.
All right.
Loved it. Bye.